continue our series on the giver who never stops giving. And I want to speak this morning from Luke's Gospel, but I want to speak to us at the time in our country right now. The tragedy of Grenfell Tower in Kensington, London this week raised uncomfortable questions about the nature of our society today. Kensington, the richest borough in London, and yet scores of people died in a neglected, inadequately protected tower block. And over the week, as we've learned more of Kensington, we've discovered that in a borough where there are lots of empty £1 million-plus flats, land grabbed by the rich, or land banked by the rich, there are 2,500 plus people living in the same borough in temporary accommodation. The tragedy has highlighted terrible divisions in our society. And now for many, a tragedy has become a cause. And there is a seething anger and resentment amongst all those who identify with the marginalised, the poor and the oppressed, and they're looking for someone to blame. This comes at a time when our nation is already terribly divided. The Brexit vote pitched the young versus the old. Young people tell it as this is the time that the older generation screwed us of our future. The terror attacks on Manchester and London were designed to further strain the religious and the ethnic racial divisions that are already in our country. And then the general election was probably the most spiteful that I've lived through in my lifetime, and it's created a toxic tone to public politics which has further highlighted these tensions and helped people become all the more angry. And then this week, the Liberal Democrat Party leadership fell apart with the gay activist Lord Paddock resigning, saying he could not agree with some of his leader's beliefs. And the following day, Tim Farron, the party's leader, resigning because he said he was finding it almost impossible to leave the party and remain true to his Christian faith. And I recommend and commend his speech to you, in which he says that liberal democracy really is at stake now with the way that Christians are being treated in the public square, and by inference he meant the gay and lesbian community. And that's the context in which we come to church this morning. That's the context in which I'm looking to Jesus to inform and inspire me how to live. And that's the context in which we come collectively this morning, seeking wisdom and inspiration. What does it mean for my words to outrun my songs, for our deeds to outweigh our words? May unbroken praise be yours. How do we live right now? Strike a chord with anybody.
Yeah.
So I want to read a couple of passages that in the Gospel of Luke come exactly side by side. And it's been long noticed that Luke was a genius editor. By that I mean Luke put stories together to tell you something. So, for example, in Luke, around chapters 10 and 11, he does this brilliant thing. You remember the story with Mary and Martha, where Jesus is at the home of Mary and Martha, and there's lots to do, and Martha's getting really busy providing all this meal, and Mary's just sitting at the feet of Jesus, listening to his words. And Martha gets more and more cross, and eventually she blows a gasket because her sister isn't helping her. And Jesus says, "Martha, Martha, Mary has chosen what is best." And that story comes in between the parable of the Good Samaritan and teaching on the Lord's Prayer. That's genius. Because Luke is saying, by putting those stories together, that actually there are these inner and outer polarities of Christian spirituality. You know, faith without works is dead. The Good Samaritan, you've got to do stuff. Martha was right, you've got to do stuff. But prayer is central to who we are, and it's who we are in God that energizes our activity on the outside. So Luke edits these stories together to make a brilliant point. Now, what happened in Luke 18 and 19 was, again, a genius, stroke of genius from Luke, the editor, as he puts two stories together. The only trouble is that some bloke in the 4th century added chapters and had no appreciation for his editing and puts a chapter division right between the two stories. But the two stories we're going to look at this morning are seamless in the book of Luke. And I pray that as we look at these two stories, not only will we learn something about the giver who never stops giving, the title of our series, and how God gives to us and wants us to respond generously, but we'll also learn something about how Jesus wants to live us to live in this divided and fractured culture right now. So, there's the tower. Let that shape our understanding of God's word this morning. So, Luke 18. The first story is about Jesus and this blind man as Jesus approached Jericho. So it's coming to the Passover, and Jesus is going through Jericho on the way to Jerusalem. And what happened when celebrity was visiting town in the ancient Near East, their sense of hospitality and welcome would be such that they would go out of the town to meet the celebrity on the road and walk back into town with him. And so the residents of Jericho have heard Jesus is having this great miracle worker, so they've gone out to meet him, and they're walking back with him into their town, hoping he's going to stay, because he is really interesting. After all, he makes people wealthy, he casts out demons, he even raises the dead. This is an interesting guy to have around, and people are looking forward to his visit. As Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. So this may well be taking place at the gate of the city as they were entering into Jericho. Now, Mark's gospel tells us the man's name, this blind man, this beggar. His name is Bartimaeus. You know what Bartimaeus means? It means son of filth. What a terrible name for living. And he's been blind from birth, and he spent his whole life at the gates begging for money to cope with his disability. And when he heard the crowd going by, he asked, "What's happening?" And they told him, notice the title, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." So, verse 38, he called out, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Now, that is really significant. It's significant because when you're sitting by the roadside, you haven't got any sight, your hearing is particularly attuned, and he's been listening to the conversation. Remember, a few minutes before, the crowd has gone out to meet Jesus from Jericho, and now they're walking back in with him. And this blind man has heard about the miracle working Jesus. This blind man has heard some of the, maybe even the stories that he's told as the conversations have gone on, just catching snippets of conversations as people have walked past. But what's really significant is that he doesn't address Jesus as he shouts out from his place of begging. He doesn't address Jesus by the name he was told. Jesus of Nazareth is coming, and the blind man Bartimaeus calls out, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Why is that significant? It's significant because the Jews expected a Messiah, and the Messiah was going to come from the line of David. And so when Bartimaeus shouted, "Son of David," he was saying, "I've heard the stories they tell about you. I believe you to be the Messiah." Wow. He has assumed that faith by listening to what the crowd had been saying. Verse 39, those who led the way, who were coming back into the city with Jesus, rebuked him and told him to be quiet. Quite literally in the Aramaic, and trust me, I read a book on this, I don't know any Aramaic, but apparently the Aramaic precisely is, "Son of filth, shut your mouth." It's really ostracizing, it is really brutal, it's very direct. You are a poor, blind beggar, shut up, we've got Jesus. They want to exclude him, they want to push him away. That's the... So, son of filth, shut your mouth. So But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Now Bartimaeus had one thing going for him. If you're a beggar and you're going to make your living from being a beggar, you've got to have a good set of lungs on you. And in the Jewish culture, you needed a good set of lungs on you for two reasons. Number one, you needed to get people's attention. And let's face it, all of us have a natural tendency to want to avoid beggars. So if you're blind, you've somehow got to get in these people's faces. So he's really got some, you know, developed some resonance and some ability to shout. But the interesting thing in a Jewish religious and pious culture is that actually pious Jews were expected to give money to beggars. It was part of their religious duty. But they didn't do it for free. As the coppers went into the tin, the coppers, as the shekels, denarii, whatever, went into the tin, the beggar was expected to proclaim what a good, religious, devout, holy, generous person you were. And as you walked down the road, you would bask in the adoration of this guy's rhetoric as he's shouting behind you. So, do you get the picture? If Bartimaeus wants this bloke to come back, he's going to keep shouting for a very long time, because the longer he walks, the more better he looks in front of the whole community. That's how religious pious communities worked, apparently. So, Bartimaeus has got a set of lungs on him, and he is absolutely determined not to be quiet. He shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Verse 40. Notice the genius of Jesus. Jesus could very easily have wandered over. But what he does is he gets the people who are telling Bartimaeus to shut his mouth to go and get Bartimaeus for him. Do you see what he does? He positions himself between the crowd and Bartimaeus. Jesus does not like the way they're responding to him, so he gets him and he gets the crowd to do his bidding. Genius. So they bring Bartimaeus to Jesus. And in verse 41, Jesus asks a bit of a daft question on the surface of things. "What do you want me to do for you?" He's blind! "Boy, are you likely to get me a car?" That's just nuts. But actually, as I read the commentaries this week, this guy's been blind from birth. He's had no education. He's got no formal training. He's got nothing to fall back on. In a pious culture, you can make a living from being a beggar. If Jesus is going to heal him, everything is going to change. Does he want that uncertainty? Does he want that set of new challenges that await him now that he can't make a living from begging? That's what Jesus is asking. And Bartimaeus passes the test. "Lord, I want to see," he replied. Again, the phrase "Lord" is significant about the faith that Bartimaeus has already put in Jesus by reputation. And Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight, your faith has healed you." Bartimaeus has shown faith. He's shown faith that Jesus is the Messiah. He's shown faith that Jesus would have compassion on him. He's shown faith that Jesus had the power to heal. "Your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. Do you remember? Bartimaeus has only got one gift. It's a set of lungs. And now he's a set of lungs with a story to tell. And he starts celebrating. And what happens? The crowd that had been trying to obscure him, they also joined in praising God. And then, without any pause, Luke goes straight on to what happens as Jesus is coming out the other side of Jericho. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. Everybody would have wanted him to stay, a miracle worker, but Jesus has made the point, "I'm passing through, I'm not stopping in Jericho, I'm on the way to Jerusalem." And a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and he was wealthy. Let me set the scene for you. If you were a Jew in the time of Jesus, you paid four different types of taxes. To the Jewish authorities, you paid a temple tax, which paid for the priests and the temple. But because they were under Roman law, there were three other taxes they had to pay. There was an income tax, there was VAT, they called it a custom tax, and then there was road tolls, to use any of the Roman roads. But the real abuse of the system was that actually the Romans farmed this taxation process out. They set it up for private entrepreneurs. And they tempted Jews to become collaborators with them. And how it would work is a wealthy Jew would come to the Romans and say, I'm prepared to collect taxes on your behalf in this area, and I will pay you 10,000 denarii a year for that. They would give the money over, and then they would take over claiming those three types of taxes. And it was completely arbitrary. They would make values on the goods being traded. They would make judgments about how much it would cost to travel on a particular road. And they completely screwed their countrymen. Experts today think that in the time of Jesus, people were paying between 30 and 40% of their income on tax. As people like Zacchaeus just farmed and milked the system. And he's even worse because he's got an army of tax collectors working for him. And they had a cut and he got a cut. And all Luke says was he was a chief tax collector and he was wealthy. If you were a Jew and a tax collector, you got excommunicated. You were treated like a prostitute. The technical frame was they were apostate. They were no longer treated as Jews. Their sin was that bad. Then we've got records of rabbis' discussions saying, could a tax collector actually be forgiven? And many rabbis thought that their sin was too great because they screwed over their countrymen to pay for their enemy and blind their own prophets. They were hated and despised. So Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector and he was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. Let's be clear, Zacchaeus was short, so he couldn't see over the crowd. But his biggest problem wasn't that he was short. His biggest problem was he was a tax collector, he was a collaborator. He couldn't see over the crowd, but the real problem was he couldn't get into the crowd. Because if he went into the crowd, he might not come out. There is a seething anger about these people. Quick knife to the chest, in a crowd, nobody would know. So he was too small to look over it, but he was a tax collector and so couldn't go in. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree. Now this is really interesting because in the ancient Near East, respectable men didn't do two things. They didn't run and they didn't climb. In fact, in the 1950s, the American ambassador to Egypt climbed up a tree in the grounds of the embassy to put up some lights for a party. And the next time he went to see President Nasser of Egypt, the story had already got round that the whole conversation that President Nasser had with the ambassador of America was, you climbed a tree. What did you do that for? That was in the 1950s. So imagine two millennia before. Anyway, a long time ago. This was a big deal. Zacchaeus runs ahead and he climbs a tree. The other thing that's really important is that it's a sycamore tree. Now, that locates the story. Because a sycamore tree grew with low branches and big leaves. It was easy to climb. But in its kind of shadow, it created this private place. Because the big branches came out and then there were all these big leaves. And in a world where there weren't many public toilets, sycamore trees became popular. So in the Mishnah, which is the Jewish oral law, it says that you can't grow a sycamore tree within 75 feet of the nearest house. Because if somebody goes in there and has a whittle, just, you know, late at night when nobody can see them, it makes the local houses nearby impure. Unacceptable for Jewish worship. So there's a rule in the Mishnah that the sycamore trees have to grow at least 75 feet away from the house. So in other words, this is Jesus on the way out of Jericho, the other side. So Zacchaeus has run all the way through the city, got over the town, has got into this tree, and he's waiting for Jesus to come by on the road because he knows the road to Jerusalem. Everybody with him. All of that's quite, you know, interesting. So, verse 5. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house. Now, it is possible that Jesus had a word of knowledge and knew Zacchaeus' name. After all, he's just healed a blind man. It's not too much more difficult to just know a bloke's name. But the natural explanation of how Jesus knew Zacchaeus' name is possibly more significant for the story. Think about the atmosphere. For a Jew under Roman occupation, life was miserable, and there is lots of resentment and anger in the atmosphere. Economically crippled, militarily oppressed, horrendous human rights abuses, religiously under constant pressure, there is a simmering anger in first century Palestine. And we know that because there were kind of messiah figures causing revolutions all over the place. One church, one historian said, no sooner than a Jewish rebellion in one area was put down, it started off in somewhere else. There is a simmering anger about this place. In that situation, when resentments run deep and hardship is real, there is huge anger just under the surface. And emotionally, crowds want someone to blame. They want a scapegoat for everybody's woes. And now they've got a chief tax collector up a tree and he's surrounded. Maybe that's how Jesus knew Zacchaeus' name, because they were screaming at him. And one of my favourite writers, Kenneth Bailey, who's an American academic who spent his whole life in the Middle East, and he lectured me when I was in college and was just an astonishing individual. He says that actually it was because of the potential threat of violence to Zacchaeus that Jesus steps into the story. And what happens is that Jesus invites himself to tea. Now think about that. In the ancient Near East, you never invited yourself. You waited to be invited. There were lots of protocols and laws about being invited into somebody's house and being offered hospitality. And besides, anybody who goes to Zacchaeus' house, who eats his food, who sleeps in their bed overnight, he is going to be ceremonially unclean. And Jesus is on his way to the Passover and worship at the temple in Jerusalem. What he is about to do at Zacchaeus' house makes the whole point of his trip impossible. And besides, he's just told the people in Jericho, no, I'm passing through, I'm going to Jerusalem. And now he is going to eat with the chief of collaborators. You see what Jesus does? Jesus again steps into the gap between the crowd, the mob, and the individual. With the blind man, Jesus stepped into the mob between the oppressed and the mob. With Zacchaeus, he stepped into the gap between the oppressor and the mob. Do you see why Luke has stuck these stories together? Jesus intervenes. And Zacchaeus, receiving such grace, radically changes a lifetime of thinking and habit and behavior. And when he goes... can you move on to the next one, please? When he goes to Zacchaeus' house, the crowd across, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stands up and says to everyone, look, Lord, here now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. A whole life of greed revolutionized by one moment of unconditional love and acceptance by Jesus. And what does Jesus say? Today, salvation has come to this house. Notice two things about this. If salvation has come, someone bought it. Jesus is saying he's God, because only God saves. The second thing is that this is evidence that Zacchaeus' life and attitude has been transformed. It's not earning salvation, because he hasn't done anything yet. Being saved is about how we view Jesus. We can never work our way to God. Our works are a revelation of the fact that already our life has changed and been transformed and is orientated towards God. Jesus says salvation has come before Zacchaeus actually does anything. Jesus sees that his words reflect a changed heart. Today, salvation has come to your house. So, notice what Jesus did. With Bartimaeus, Jesus stood between the oppressed and the mob. And with Zacchaeus, Jesus stood between the oppressor and the mob. So what? I want to make two quick points. The first is this. We live in a nation right now where there is also justifiable reason for the poor and marginalized to be very angry. Forget the argument about whether we should have grammar schools in our education system. We don't just have a two-tier education system. We have a two-tier society. The haves and the have-nots. Private health for those who can afford it, and NHS for everyone else. If you are massively in debt and have your benefits cut and you can't access the support for the help you need for those you love and you're on a 0 hours contract and at the same time the media is saturating us with images of the ideal Western lifestyle, who wouldn't feel the system was unjust? Who wouldn't be angry? And make no mistake, where justifiable anger burns, there are always those who want to exploit it for their own ends. That's how the Nazi Party started in Germany, exploiting that sense of being forgotten and marginalized. That's how ISIS thrives around the world. That's why riots happen, that's why people join criminal gangs. Please hear this. Today, our politicians and our media have a very grave responsibility to respond and reflect that anger without fueling it. And there are sections of both of them which, in my view, are failing to do that by some considerable margin. There are even people out there exploiting genuine anger for their own ends, whether it's vote or ratings. We would do well to remember that Jesus was crucified by a mob. When mobs are angry, they act irrationally. You can be justifiably angry, but your anger, as all of us know, can be very self-destructive, it can be very irrational. And the mob that killed Jesus was entirely irrational. They were just seething with anger, and this man had disappointed them and let them down. We would do well to remember that in both of these stories, Jesus puts himself between the mob and the oppressed, but also the mob and the oppressor. We are going to have to learn to be the same as that, as the Church of Jesus Christ. When we side with the mob, we ought to be very, very nervous about where Jesus is. One of the divisions in society right now that I have referred to earlier was the division between what I could crudely call the gay and lesbian lobby and the Christian church. And I just wonder whether 30 or 40 years ago, if the church had understood this and we had said, you know what, we believe that marriage is between men and women, but we really believe the gay community's rights have got to be protected. And we stood between the mob and the gay community when it was unpopular. I wonder whether we'd be in a different place now in our fractured relationships. Speculation. But we would also do very well to remember, if you're one of those people who's seething with anger right now about the injustice injustice of a two-tier British political system, please also remember that there are millions of refugees around the world who feel exactly the same as about you. That you're part of a European society which has locked them out when they have been fleeing genocidal persecution, famine and all the rest of it, and we won't allow our lifestyles to be disturbed to accommodate any of them. So before we point the finger, we better remember that we're being pointed at. Somehow the church in this country has got to rise above the tenor of our conversation right now and live for something different. And I see clues here in the example of Jesus that he stands up for the oppressed whilst offering salvation to the oppressor. When I read this story, it exposed, you know, when I saw that tower, it makes me so angry. I want a scapegoat. I want somebody to blame. Somebody we can nail this on. And if anybody saw the interview with Theresa May on Newsnight this week, you can see that the interviewer wanted to do exactly the same with her. We have to recognise when something awful like this happens, the nature, with a mob mentality, we want a scapegoat. And it's not the way of Jesus. That's not to say that there shouldn't be a public investigation and people should be discovered, but there is a big issue here. Do you hear what I'm saying? Food for thought. The second thing to say is this. Look what happened to the Bartimaeus and Zacchaeus. What did they have in common? As soon as they met Jesus, they immediately used their gift for Jesus. They had been so lavishly and wonderfully treated, they bought for the party exactly what they had. What did Bartimaeus have? He had a story and a good set of runs, and he just started proclaiming his story. Now, Zacchaeus didn't have that, but he did have money, and he bought his money to be part of this unfolding story of Jesus bringing liberation and good news and freedom and grace and mercy. And it was instantaneous. As soon as they met Jesus, they immediately used their gift for Jesus. How about you? How's your gift being used for Jesus? You know, sometimes in the church, we go, oh, you're on the rotor. That's not quite the mentality here. The mentality is, freely we receive, freely give. Wow! God has reached out to me with such grace and such mercy. I've been forgiven, I've been set free. He's now my friend, my saviour, my Lord. I have eternity secure with him. Wow! I'm bringing everything I am to this party. That's a very big difference. There is a million miles between a rotor and a ministry. A rotary is, oh, I suppose someone better do that. A ministry is, wow, God, I want to bring everything you've wired me up to be, and I want to give it to you and say, God, you've so incredibly touched my life, I can't wait to give back to you. I love it when I just see people just bringing with delight and joy the way God has wired them up to be and partnering with Jesus in his purposes. I get to see that all the time. I had a phone call this week from someone who has been made redundant recently, and he's out of a job. And they just rang me and said, okay, 2 days a week, what can I do? What can I do? I can, you know, sit around moping at home thinking, oh, I'm going to fill in for another movie, I need another job. But in the meantime, what can I do? How can I get in on the story of Jesus blessing others like Jesus has blessed me? Now that's a moment to say, woo-hoo-hoo! That's somebody who gets it. That's a Bartimaeus. That's a Zacchaeus. That's not a rotor. That's a life form. I want to partner with Jesus. I went out around an art exhibition this week. I'm very cultured, I know, I don't look it, but I went around this art exhibition, and there was this brilliant Christian artist who was just using her gift to make some statements about the world, about the nature of truth, about as it happened in this instance, Calcutta. And it was just beautiful. And besides, their work was some of the best on display. It was just partnership. And, you know, guys, recently, we've got a family in the church who are facing real adversity, and a whole bunch of guys got together, and it was like that makeover program on TV. 1 week the house looked like this, 2 weeks later, transformed. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. The people had bowled over.
And it's not a rota, it's because freely we receive, freely we want to give. Zacchaeus and Bartimaeus, their first instinctive moment is, wow, I've got to give what I've got. It's all the difference between a rota and a ministry. Freely we receive, freely give. So, final slide. Summary of the two stories. Jesus stood with the oppressed, but at the same time extends grace to the oppressor. When Jesus said he came to seek and save the lost were not just the economically poor. Jesus demonstrates salvation both to the oppressed and the oppressor. Jesus stands between the mob and the individual. As soon as Bartimaeus and Zacchaeus met Jesus, they immediately started using their gifts for Jesus. Grace is costly, both for the one who gives it and the one who receives it. What we have in these stories is a foreshadowing of the cross. Jesus stood before the mob for Bartimaeus. Jesus stood before the mob for Zacchaeus. Jesus stood